I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, the Iranian president makes a landmark visit to Egypt. Iranian and EU officials name a date and a place for nuclear talks. Syrian refugees in Iraq are facing a harsh winter.
We didn't come here for pleasure. We're suffering. Our house was destroyed. We lost everything.
And an all-girl band folds after a Muslim cleric issues a fatwa. It's all ahead. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is in Cairo, the first leader of the Islamic Republic to visit Egypt since the countries broke relations more than 30 years ago. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett has more on the story from the Egyptian capital.
President Ahmadinejad embraced fellow Islamist Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi upon arrival in Cairo. The Iranian president is in the capital for a summit of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, but warming relations between Egypt and Iran dominated the first day of the trip. Mr. Ahmadinejad's meeting Tuesday with the Grand Sheikh of Al-Azhar, a venerable seat of Sunni learning, marks a symbolic rapprochement in the sectarian divides roiling the region. And while Shiite-led Iran does not have full diplomatic ties with Egypt, broken in 1980 over Iran's revolution and Egypt's recognition of Israel, the visit pushes the nations closer in that direction. More immediately divisive is the question of Syria. Mr. Morsi used a breakthrough visit to Tehran last year to castigate Iranian leaders for backing the Syrian government. Iran has supported popular uprisings in Egypt, Libya, and Bahrain, for example, but has come down strongly in favor of the Syrian status quo, a government led by Alawites, a Shiite offshoot. Despite the differences, some political observers believe Iran is keen to nurture ties with Egyptian Islamists to act as a regional counterweight to Tehran's rivals in the Sunni-led Arab states of the Gulf. The head of the Saudi-based Gulf Research Center, Abdulaziz Sagar.
Iran has tried by getting closer to Egypt to eliminate the Gulf and to give much more regional role for Egypt, and in this way they support the Muslim Brotherhood leadership.
Israel remains a factor in relations. On the eve of his trip, Mr. Ahmadinejad told Lebanon's Al-Mayadeen TV that the political geography of the region will change if Egypt and Iran take a unified stance on the Palestinian question. Mr. Morsi's background as a leader of the Muslim Brotherhood has translated to close ties with the Iranian-backed Palestinian faction Hamas, but Egypt's new government says it will abide by its peace treaty with Israel. Egypt, too, has practical concerns, including monetary support from the Gulf in the form of direct aid and emigrant workers' remittances. It's also trying to keep relations on course with the United States, another source of aid, and the driving force to isolate Iran over its nuclear program. Political observers say such thorny issues mean that while cooperation between Egypt and Iran may be on the rise, full relations appear still a ways off. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
European Union Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton says she is hoping for concrete progress in a new round of talks with Iran about its controversial nuclear program. Iranian and EU officials announced today they have agreed to meet February 26 in Kazakhstan. Iran and the so-called P5 plus one contact group, the United States, France, Russia, China, Britain, and Germany, last held negotiations in June, but the talks broke apart, with neither side yielding on its demands. We asked Lacey Healy, senior policy analyst with the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, her reaction to announcement of a date and place for renewed talks.
It's very good news. This is great that they have finally agreed to a date. There's been a lot of back and forth and a lot of stalling on Iran's end, or it was seen as stalling for a long time. I know it was hard to, they had a lot of trouble deciding on a location and a date, and I think as well as an agenda. So this is great news that both sides have finally agreed to meet and that we can really move forward on this diplomatic deal.
What do you think they should talk about?
Well, they're going to need to move beyond what they've talked about in the past. I think both sides are going to have to come to the table with more willingness to compromise and more ability to offer things up that they haven't necessarily offered up in the past. I think Iran is going to have to be willing to stop its 20% uranium enrichment. It's going to have to be willing to dismantle its uranium enrichment capability at one of its nuclear facilities. And it's going to have to be willing to ship out a certain amount of its uranium as well. But on the same side, I mean, the U.S. is going to have to also come to the table with an offer that suspends the implementation of existing sanctions and really, you know, gives Iran a reason to compromise. They're going to have to really deal with sanctions this time. I think that's going to be the key.
We've been around and around on this subject for years. Do you have any optimism that something can really be accomplished this time?
I really think that we're coming down to a point where we have to find compromise. And I think Iran knows that. I think the U.S. knows that. And ultimately, you know, this is a tipping point. This is a time that that I do hope that we can find compromise. I think that Iran, they're masters at stalling, but ultimately they are they're not crazy. They're looking for some kind of compromise. They're not looking to go to war, and neither are we. And I think that if there's a time, this is the time.
Do you think it's the sanctions and also the threats from Israel that is making this the time?
Absolutely. This is the threat is more real than it's ever been, and I think the Iranians know that. I think they're also hurting from sanctions. We know that the sanctions are hurting the country. And this ultimately, all of that coming together, is going to push this forward.
Lacey Healy, Senior Policy Analyst with the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation here in Washington. Some Western nations, including the U.S., believe Iran is secretly trying to develop nuclear weapons. Iran says its nuclear program is peaceful. The United Nations Security Council has demanded in multiple resolutions that Iran suspend all enrichment-related activities and allow U.N. inspectors to access its nuclear facilities. VOA invites you to share a glimpse of your life through photography and become eligible to win a new iPad. VOA helps give you insights into the world. Now we want you to share your world with us. Send us your best photos, ones that capture the spirit or the essence of the people and places in your life. VOA judges will choose a winner. For a complete list of contest rules, go to voanews.com/iPad. Exiled Syrian opposition leader Maoz al-Khatib has expanded on an offer to hold peace talks with the Syrian government, saying he is willing to sit down with the deputy of President Bashar al-Assad. In interviews with Arab television networks Monday, the leader of the Syrian National Coalition said he is extending a hand to Syrian Vice President Farouk al-Sharaa to negotiate what he called a peaceful departure of the regime. Al-Khatib said he wants to pursue negotiations with the Assad government because he has concluded that only Syrians can find a solution to the country's civil war. Al-Khatib said his offer of talks puts the ball in the government's court, but there was no immediate response from Mr. Assad, who has proposed his own national reconciliation process that offers elections and a new constitution but keeps him in power. Al-Khatib first made the offer last week, saying it was conditional on the government freeing tens of thousands of prisoners and providing passports to Syrians exiled by the rebellion against Mr. Assad's authoritarian rule. The proposal angered some members of the opposition coalition, which previously had demanded that Mr. Assad leave power before negotiations could begin. U.S. State Department spokesperson Victoria Nuland, talking with reporters, said if the Assad government has any interest in peace, it should sit down and talk now with the opposition coalition.
We've long said that those with blood on their hands in Syria need to be held accountable, that it's up to the Syrian people to determine how they should be held accountable. That said, I don't think there was anything in what President al-Khatib said that implied that he thought there should be immunity of any kind. He simply reiterated the offer that he's been making for a number of days, and which we very much welcome, that if the regime has any interest in peace, it should sit down and talk now with the Syrian opposition coalition, and we would strongly support al-Khatib in that call.
You would oppose immunity?
Again, we have said, as have the Syrian people, that those with blood on their hands need to be held to account. I don't think there's anything in what President al-Khatib has said that undercuts that concern of the Syrian people.
U.S. State Department spokesperson Victoria Nuland. U.N. humanitarian agency UNICEF said it has started an operation to deliver water treatment chemicals to Syria to provide safe water supplies to 10 million people, almost half the country's population. It said the first four trucks carrying 80 tons of chlorine crossed from Jordan into Syria on Sunday, bound for the regions of Homs, Aleppo, Hama, and Idlib. As the conflict in Syria approaches its second anniversary, the number of refugees crossing into Iraq continues to rise. The United Nations and international relief organizations are no longer able to provide aid to Syrian families who are facing dire winter conditions in flimsy, ill-equipped camps. Sebastian Meyer reports for VOA Television from Arbat in northern Iraq.
Freezing rain falls on the Arbat refugee camp in northern Iraq, more than 400 kilometers from the Syrian border. In the past 5 months, more than 500 Syrian refugees have traveled to this ad hoc camp in the middle of a bean field. The children, who are not playing outside in the mud, try to stay warm by burning refuse found in an abandoned sheep barn. Fuaz Akil is an ethnic Kurd from the Syrian city of Deir ez-Zor. He's living with his family of 10 in a tent donated by the semi-autonomous Kurdish government of northern Iraq.
We didn't come here for pleasure. We're suffering. Our house was destroyed. We lost everything. We came here because this is Kurdistan and these are our people. But still, we are suffering. We're not living in this tent for fun. We had our own house. We had our own car, our own tractor.
With more than 80,000 Syrian refugees in Iraq, the UN and other international agencies are no longer able to provide essential aid to those crossing the border. Tents, toilets, and food have been donated by the local government or by local charities. Fatma Musa, also a Kurd, traveled nearly 1,000 kilometers from Aleppo after her house was destroyed by a rocket.
It was the middle of the night when we left Aleppo. We were driven to Hasaka and then to the Iraqi border. It was snowing and I had to carry my son on my back.
As the rain falls, children dart between shelters trying to stay dry. With the conflict in Syria showing no signs of abating, these refugees will continue to suffer through a harsh winter in the foothills of Iraq. Sebastian Meyer for VOA News, Arbat, Iraq.
Diplomats were urging Libya's new rulers as long as last summer to move quickly on deciding the process for drafting a new constitution. But 6 months after the country held an election in July, the first one in a half century, nothing significant has happened. Jamie Detmer has details.
Libyans are frustrated by the slow pace of change in the country and say the delay on the constitution isn't helping the central government to persuade tens of thousands of rebel militiamen to lay down their arms. One of the biggest hold-ups on deciding how to go about writing a new Libyan constitution is disagreement about whether the members of a 60-strong drafting panel should be elected or appointed by the country's new parliament, the General National Congress. Another is that politicians can't agree on how to make the process inclusive to ensure that Libya's three regions and women have an opportunity to shape the constitution. Alexander Graf Lambsdorff, a German member of the European Parliament, who headed an observation team to Libya, says speed is now important.
We believe the decision on the procedure for the selection of the members of the Constitutional Committee must urgently be made. The continued success of the transition in Libya depends on this committee's work.
Women fear they will have little influence on a draft constitution that has to be voted on in a referendum before it can become the law of the land. They are insisting they have fair representation on any drafting panel, however it is chosen.
We therefore believe that it should be inclusive, and that means also an important role for women on the constitutional committee. We believe that is the best way to arrive at a constitution that then commands the broad support of all segments of society.
Diplomats and international legal experts say for the process to be inclusive, there must be plenty of time for Libyans to have a chance to make their views known to the panel, and that alone could take 3 months.
I think the more pragmatic way is to organize a broad public consultation process prior to the official start of the committee's work. That public consultation process could easily be 3 months and would allow, you know, regional interests to be voiced, civil society interests to be voiced, women's interests to be voiced.
Women activists warned that Libya's government should not follow the example of President Mohamed Morsi in neighboring Egypt, where a rushed process led to accusations of a lack of inclusiveness and prompted a violent standoff last year. Former Tripoli school principal and political activist Lutfia Al-Tabib says some Libyan men claim they know about women's rights and what's best for women. She disputes the idea that there don't have to be women on the committee.
But she says there should be at least 35% of the committee should be women.
Women parliamentarians have now formed a cross-party bloc with the aim of ensuring fair female representation on the Constitutional Drafting Committee. But the extent of their participation remains in hot debate.
That was reporter Jamie Detmeyer. In Indian Kashmir, an all-girl rock band has called it quits after a Muslim cleric issued a fatwa calling on them to disband. As Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi, assurances of protection from the state government apparently failed to reassure the teenage girls.
The three high school girls had enthusiastically formed the rock band after winning an annual music contest held in the Kashmiri capital, Srinagar, in December. They called it Pragash, which means from darkness to light. It was the Muslim majority state's first all-girl music band. But it folded up a day after the chief Muslim cleric of Jammu and Kashmir, Bashiruddin Ahmed, said singing is un-Islamic and issued a fatwa calling for them to disband. His edict followed an online campaign of threats and hate messages targeting the teenage girls. Amid the outcry which followed, the state's chief minister, Omar Abdullah, extended assurances of police protection to the girls and hoped they would not allow a handful of morons to silence their music. Politicians, artists and media across the country rallied to their support. Manish Tiwari is the Federal Information and Broadcasting Minister.
We do hope that on this issue, across the political spectrum in Jammu and Kashmir, there would be a degree of unanimity which would ensure that the freedom of speech and expression can be allowed to flourish without any curbs on it.
The head of the opposition People's Democratic Party in Kashmir, Mehbooba Mufti, says she is taken aback by the controversy because Kashmir boasts of a long line of successful women artists.
Even I am surprised because, you know, Kashmiris have admired their women singers. We have great singers and people really love, you know, their singing. We have been listening to their songs all through our life, even the older generation. This whole issue has kind of painted Kashmiris as if they are women haters. They live in some kind of, you know, stone age, which is contrary to what Kashmiris are. They are very emancipated.
Mehbooba Mufti says the controversy is getting a lot of publicity. She says following one religious ruling would only encourage further edicts.
If we don't put our foot down at this point of time, it has started with these three young girls. Tomorrow they will be dictating something else. Then something else may come. We need to, you know, stop it here, but it's not about religion.
The rock band initially also faced the ire of the separatist Hurriyat conference in Kashmir, which said there is no room to nourish Western culture in the state. But following the national outcry, it stepped back and said it had nothing to do with the fatwa. Kashmir is a Muslim majority state and hardline Islamists have tried to impose Islamic law since the onset of an anti-India insurgency in 1990. Last year, a Kashmiri religious group, the Jamaat-e-Islami, said tourists should follow a dress code and not move around in miniskirts and other objectionable dresses. It was largely ignored. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.